Excellent. Dan, thank you and good morning. A little twist for us today is we're doing it in the AM and not the PM. I like this. We may have to do this more often. Thank you, as always, for making this happen. I appreciate all your work. Hello, everyone. As Dan mentioned, I'm Eric Cini, and I'm excited to share this next edition of the Wealth Planning Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Plans. This is a strategy that business owners have been using for years as a way to sell their business. ESOPs are a unique approach to the sale of a business because it gives the ability for the business owner to provide a significant tax deferral while at the same time creating some liquidity over time for the selling business owner. So it's something that we see a lot of business owners have a significant interest in. So like many of the topics that we tackle here on the podcast, this one has some complexities that are best handled by those very experienced in the space. And so what I wanted to do today was bring a couple of resident specialists who can speak directly to this idea. So joining me today to discuss ESOP are my good friends and longtime colleagues, Keith Afton and Nick Francia, managing directors here at UBS. And together they are the co-heads of the Capital ESOP Group. Keith and Nick, welcome. Thank you as always for spending some time with us. And Nick, if you don't mind, I'd love to, if you could start off by just telling us a little bit about your team.
Thank you, Erica. Appreciate it. It's always great to spend time with you. Just brief introduction, Keith and I co-head the Capital ESOP Group for UBS nationally. We manage an 11-person team with offices in Washington, D.C. and in New York City. And our entire practice over the last 20-plus years has been dedicated to advising business owners on different ways to structure and implement ESOP transactions.
Okay. All right. So yeah, I know you've been doing it a long time. We've worked together a bunch. Thank you for joining me again. And so today what we're going to talk about is I just want to get into the nuts and bolts a little bit. We could certainly spend some hours doing this, but we're going to try to do it all in about 20 minutes to give everybody a big picture. So a lot of our listeners are probably not completely familiar with the strategy. So to get started, could you both give us just sort of a high-level explanation of how a sale to an ESOP works?
Absolutely. I think for context, you've got to identify what an ESOP actually is. And an ESOP is a way for a privately held business owner to sell a portion or all of their stock, defer with the proper planning, permanently avoid paying the capital gains tax, and at the same time rewarding employees. And the way that we break it down is we would define an ESOP as a flexible, tax-efficient exit strategy. And the flexibility of an ESOP comes from the fact that we are creating a buyer. So the ESOP is nothing more than a tax-exempt trust. It's created by attorneys. So when you think about selling equity of a privately held business, you can sell equity to a strategic buyer. You can sell equity to a private equity firm, or you can sell equity to an ESOP. And so by creating the buyer, the business owner has the flexibility to sell any amount of stock that they want. You can sell as little as 1%. You can sell as much as 100%. So as you know, business owners all have their own goals and objectives. They may want to sell for diversification purposes. They may want to sell to lock in today's value. But through conversations, you figure out what makes the most sense, and the business owner can ultimately decide how much stock they want to sell to accomplish their own family's goals and objectives. So that's the flexibility. The tax efficiency comes in two forms. One at the corporate level and one at the individual level. At the corporate level, because an ESOP is a tax-exempt trust, and as a company taxed as an S-corporation, that would be a pass-through entity. So as profits flow through the company to the ultimate shareholder, if the ESOP is the shareholder, to the extent that the ESOP owns shares, the company operates federally and state income tax-free. So in a 100% ESOP-owned company, taxed as an S-corp, the company actually operates tax-exempt. So when you compare that to an individual owning a business, individuals pay ordinary income tax on all profits that the business achieves. With the ESOP, because of the tax benefits, you can almost double the free cash flow of the business for purposes of repaying debt, making acquisitions, reinvesting back into the company, bonusing out employees, et cetera. So that would be the tax benefit at the corporate level. At the individual level, there's a section of the Internal Revenue Code that was put in place in 1986 called Section 1042, which allows a business owner the opportunity to defer or, with the proper planning, permanently avoid paying capital gains tax in connection with the transaction. So from a capital gains tax perspective, in today's environment, you're looking at 20% federal long-term capital gains tax, a 3.8% Medicare surtax that may or may not apply, and then state tax. State taxes can range anywhere from 0% in a state like Florida all the way up to 13.3% in a state like California. So when we're working with advisors and clients, we're really focusing on the after-tax benefit to the client when they're looking at selling stock. And then finally, we define it as an exit strategy. And an exit strategy because an ESOP is a tax-efficient leveraged buyout. And in a 100% ESOP transaction, the owner is not going to get 100% cash at close. They'll get a portion of the money in the form of close and a portion of the money in the form of a seller note. So you really have to believe in the solvency and the longevity of the company long-term for an ESOP to be successful and for an ESOP to make sense.
Thank you for that. I think that's very helpful. It lays out the tax component, I think, really well. And I think that last thing you just said also makes a lot of sense to me in terms of how we talk about planning, right? Because that's the part where we come in is talking about that exit strategy element and saying, okay, well, how does this fit into your overall goals? Are you going to be there right away? Are you trying to get cash right away? As you said, that's not necessarily what's going to happen. But there is certainly a lot of benefit doing this. In terms of how the exit strategy element of it plays into the bigger picture for the client slash business owner's plans to transition out of the business. One of the common misconceptions with ESOPs over the years seems to have been that, you know, the employees are buying the stock. But I don't believe that's the case, as we've always said. So can you tell us how this works and how the ESOP actually gets funded? I think that would really help as well.
Absolutely. And it's a great question because you're correct. The common misconception is clients will call us and say, I like the benefit from an intrinsic perspective. I like the benefit from a tax perspective, but my employees don't have the money to buy my stock. And the good news is the employees never take a single dollar out of their pocket to purchase stock. The way that an ESOP is funded is actually through a commercial loan. So to go through this quickly, if you think about a $50 million company, $50 million value company. That company has the ability to take on debt, right, through their assets on the balance sheet, projections, accounts receivables, et cetera. So if that $50 million company has the ability to borrow $20 million from a commercial lender, right, commercial lenders want to make loans to companies. So a commercial lender will come in and they'll lend $20 million to the company. The company will then take that $20 million of fresh cash and lend it to the ESOP trust. So now what you've done mechanically is you've actually funded the buyer with cash. The ESOP trust then turns to the selling shareholder and asks, how much stock do you want to sell? In the event that the business owner wants to sell 40% of their equity for $20 million, the selling shareholder sells $20 million of stock into the ESOP. The ESOP gives the selling shareholder $20 million of cash. So at the end of the day, in that transaction, you now have a company who has $20 million of debt on the balance sheet. You have a selling shareholder who has $20 million of cash sitting in a checking account, and that business owner still owns 60% of the equity. So they're still running and operating the company as a 60% shareholder. And at the end of the day, in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, they can choose what they want to do with that 60%, whether it's sell to the ESOP, sell to an external buyer, hold it, give it to children or grandchildren, et cetera. But the main point there, Eric, is the funding of an ESOP is coming from a commercial lender. It is not coming from the employees to purchase the equity direct from the business owner.
Yep. And I've definitely, we've had that question many times. And it's always surprising. Even sometimes attorneys who don't, focus in this space have a misconception of how that works. And I think the clients sort of start down the wrong path. But it's always great to have you and Keith here to help get us back on the right track. Having said that, it gives us a decent understanding of how it works. What advantage do you see in this type of transaction versus some of the other sale options? You know, you mentioned the private equity buyer or the strategic buyer. You know, if you were going to sort of sum up some of the pluses and minuses here, what do you see there that gives you an advantage if you're using an ESOP?
I think on the heels of a strategic or private equity, those are taxable sales. So when you start to think about, as a business owner, you've put your life's body of work in building this business, hiring people, training people, you know, time away from your family to build a company, and now you want to monetize it, and you're looking to oftentimes maximize value and protect your family for retirement. And one of the advantages on the heels of what you said of an ESOP versus a sale to a strategic buyer, private equity, is the economics of avoiding a capital gains tax. So to expand upon something Nick said earlier, Nick touched on the flexibility, and he also talked about Section 1042. So Section 1042 of the Internal Revenue Code says with certain structures, an owner can sell stock to an ESOP and avoid the Medicare surtax, the federal capital gains tax, and the state capital gains tax. So it's a lot more cash once the company pays out that the owner is able to then have for purposes of retirement to have income and wealth for the family to carry on after they no longer have the cookie jar of the company. So there's a tax savings of avoiding capital gains tax. Some other advantages for a business owner, we often find that they really like the concept of being able to stay on. A lot of times owners start the sell-side process of engaging advisors to figure out how to monetize the company because they're really looking for diversification of wealth away from the company. On their balance sheet, most of their wealth is concentrated in this illiquid asset in the form of the privately held business. And whether they are selling part of the stock in a partial sale or 100% of the stock, in both scenarios, an advantage of the ESOP is it affords the owner the ability to stay on and continue to work at the company. And when they stay on, they're also able to continue to draw a salary, which leads into a third benefit. So they have the ability to stay on, continue to work, which a lot of them want to do. They have the ability to continue to pull a salary out of the company, oftentimes at a reduced salary from what they were otherwise taking out as the owner of the company. You can look at it as a partial sale, which is risk mitigation, diversification, where you get partial liquidity out of the company that they can then redeploy in other assets, other businesses, other parcels of real estate as investment properties, securities, whatever they want to do. We talked about the tax savings, Eric, of being able to avoid the capital gains tax. And I think the last point I'll touch upon is one of the soft characteristics, which is very true to these families, which is legacy and community. I'll use community in there with legacy. Legacy is a lot of these business owners want the ability to pass the business on to the next generation. ESOPs afford that. The kids can stay involved in the company. Family members can stay involved in the company. It allows them to keep their name on the front door instead of changing the name to what the buyer ultimately wants it to be, preserving their legacy. And I use the word community, Eric, because it does feel good as an owner to be able to monetize the stock back to an ESOP. This ESOP then allocates those shares to the plan participants, which are their employees. And so when they see the same individuals that have worked for them for 10, 15, 20, 20 plus years at the grocery store, at the hardware store in the local community, you know, those employees oftentimes come up and say thank you. It's very rewarding that they now have a benefit that they can count on for retirement that was really given to them by the owner, as opposed to the owner selling outright to a third party that oftentimes would not even secure the employment for these same employees in the community.
You just, you know, that last thing you just said, Keith, we've hit that so many times, right? The owners really do, they're building not just a business, but it's almost a family, right? And so they really do want to take care of the people that helped them create the business over the years. And so being able to take care of them is one of the many things that we hear on a regular basis from the owners is, how do I take care of these group of people? Because they, without them, it wouldn't have happened. So I think it's really great that you highlighted that. You know, Keith, one of the other things that I was just sort of thinking about from a planning perspective, you just hit a bunch of the elements, right? What's the ultimate goal? Does the owner want to get out right away? Do they want to stay in for a certain amount of time? You know, how does that all fit into their overall wealth transfer strategy? know, all that from a planning perspective is something that we end up spending a lot of time on with our clients when we're walking through all the strategies of which one's really a fit. And I think that leads me to the next question, and something that I remember hearing for the first time when you and I were out in the Midwest at a conference and you were presenting on the strategy there, and you did this great job. It was actually the first time I think I'd ever heard it, which is why I remember it, where you were talking about what makes for a good situation in terms of who's a good candidate for an ESOP, right? And it was one of the first times you'd ever walked me through it, and I was in the audience listening. But could you do that again today for us here and walk us back through that? What makes that good candidate? You know, what situations are a good fit, whereas what are some things maybe that would tilt you the other way and say maybe it's not a good fit?
Sure, I'll keep it brief. I think the way that I'd like to address that is, you know, you got to get under the hood and look at the financials of the company, and there's several conversations and several meetings before you actually know that it's a good candidate. But so it takes a little time to figure that out. But there's five things that Nick and I look for right away to almost immediately eliminate a company from being a candidate. And so what I'd say is that these five are kind of non-negotiable in our mind to make a good candidate for an ESOP. One is, Nick said earlier that these are tax-efficient leverage buyouts, LBOs, and they really are. So with that, if you're going to have an LBO with financing either from a bank or the seller, you know, you need good, predictable, reoccurring cash flow. So we need to look at a company that's been profitable over the past 3 years with a high level of certainty that they're going to continue to be profitable moving forward for the next 5, 6, 7 years. So good, predictable, reoccurring cash flow is really table stakes for a candidate. Second thing is a company that doesn't have a lot of term debt. I want to be clear to say it doesn't have to be a company that's debt-free. Every company has a revolving line of credit to fund payroll. But if a company recently borrowed a bunch of debt for an acquisition or to buy the piece of real estate that they're operating out of, then they're probably taking current cash flows to pay down term debt to an outside lender where they just borrowed money in the past couple of years for an acquisition or the piece of real estate. So what we're looking for is nice, lean, clean balance sheets with good, predictable, reoccurring cash flow, characteristic one. Characteristic two is companies that don't have a tremendous amount of outstanding term debt, which, again, I want to differentiate from a revolving line of credit or you know, funding backed by AR. The last two characteristics, I'd say, the more employees, the better. We love companies that have 1,000 employees, 2,000 employees, 500, but we tend to try to stay away from companies that have fewer than 30. For today's discussion, I'll kind of leave it at that. We could dig a little bit deeper on another conversation, but you know, I'd say the good rule of thumb is the more employees, the better, but we want to have really a minimum of 30 to be able to comfortably say it's a good candidate. And then the fourth and the fifth characteristics are you got to have a good management team. The reason is you're not bringing in an outside buyer. These are internal transactions. So because you're not bringing in an outside buyer as the operator, once the founder monetizes and is paid out in full for the stock that he or she sold, the trustee is going to want to make sure that there's a good competent bench or a good competent management team that can continue to run the profitable business that they're ultimately buying on behalf of the employees. And the last characteristic is something that Nick and I, you know, kind of coined fire in the belly. Fire in the belly to me just means somebody that doesn't mind continuing to go to work and manage the balance sheets and profits of the company. Because if you do a partial sale, you're only taking some of the money out and you still own the majority of the stock. So you want to make sure you've got fire in the belly to protect the profitability moving forward before you sell that remainder of the stock outright to a third party or to an ESOP. And if you do an 100% sale, Eric, to Nick's point, you're not getting all your cash at close. You're going to get some portion of cash at close with a promissory note or a seller note headed back to the seller over a period of time tied to cash flows. So you're going to want to make sure that owner's got fire in the belly to make sure that they, you know, have their thumbprint on that company to look at the P&L and look at the profits and make sure the company is able to service the debt.
That's perfect. No, thank you for running through that. I mean, I think it's critical that people understand, at least at a high level, here are some things that really you got to have in place if it's going to, you know, potentially be a fit. Just a quick pivot, and this will be the last question because I think we're coming up on time. One of the things we get questions from clients about is, does it have to be one or the other? Like, how do you go through the process? And I think you have always talked about this idea of a sort of a dual track approach. Can you explain the concept of what dual track means in terms of when you're looking at this business sale opportunity?
Yeah, I think the dual track is kind of the best way to frame it is I can't imagine not looking at all my options, Eric. I think every owner has an obligation to themselves and their families to just kind of look at, should I sell outright to a third party or should I do an internal transaction to include an ESOP? And the dual track accomplishes that. It allows them to sit down with a competent team of professionals that are skilled to educate them about the pros and cons of ESOPs and model out what that ESOP looks like. That's a baseline. You know, that becomes your baseline for what the economics would look like, what the timeline would look like, what it means to them and the company. And so long as they fully understand that, they can then pause and say, is this or is this not in line with my stated goals and objectives? And if they're curious, i.e. I use the word unicorn, there's that all-cash offer out there at a higher multiple. They can also go out and test the market utilizing that feasibility study or that ESOP that they've kind of looked at as the baseline or a bid, i.e. a buyer, as they go out there and test the market. And what I like about that, Eric, is it allows a family to kind of exhale when the process is run properly, to have a bid from the external market as well as an internal bid from the ESOP, and then they're able to properly sit down and figure out what's the right strategy for me based upon economics, timeline, and basically goodwill of looking after the future legacy of the company itself. So the dual track to me is just using the ESOP as a bid to go out to market to see what other parties, third parties are willing to pay.
Yeah. I think it's critical. You know, we always talk about doing what's best for the client, exploring all the options, and that dual track is a big component of that, right? It's just making sure that we've checked all the boxes as we're going through the process so that at the end of the day, the client gets the best fit for their situation. Well, listen, we've come up against it, and Keith and Nick, I really appreciate the time today. It's been fantastic. To your point, you know, we're just scratching the surface. Maybe at some point next year you indulge me and we'll come back for an ESOP 201 potentially. And if you're willing to give a little bit more time, maybe the next go around. But thank you again for stopping by the podcast.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate you guys.
For sure. So with that, that wraps another session of the Wealth Planning Podcast. We appreciate your time joining us today. For our listeners, if you have questions regarding today's discussion and you want to learn more about the ESOP strategy, please reach out to your financial advisor who can assist you in determining whether an ESOP is the right approach for you and your business, and also connect you with the expertise like Keith and Nick to start really getting educated about that strategy. So thank you again, and please join us next month for another installment of the Wealth Planning Podcast.
Please note that the views presented by third-party speakers are their own views and may not necessarily be the same as those of UBS AG and its affiliates. UBS does not attest to the accuracy and completeness of any information or associated materials provided by them. UBS makes no recommendation in relation to them or their services. Any third parties mentioned within this podcast are not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc. or its subsidiaries. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business, that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review the client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy. The key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC. UBS Financial Advisors are registered representatives of UBS Financial Services, Inc.